You're watching Channel 37. WHXN. New Salem.
The spirit of the 90s is alive both in Portland and on Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show. We're here to celebrate the independent film movement of the era with smoke signals. Then, we're here to complain about the independent film movement of the era with Living in Oblivion.
Hello, and welcome to Channel 37 Midnight Movie Show. I'm Dan, and with me are Wendy.
Hey there.
Dave.
Hello.
And Will.
Some days it's a good day to die. Some days it's a good day to have breakfast.
Very true. So it looks like we are dipping our toe in the waters of 90s indie nonsense. And Will, this was your week. What did you bring to us?
I brought to us Smoke Signals.
And what is Smoke Signals about?
Good morning. This is Randy Pion on KRES Radio. It's a good day to be indigenous.
Let's go to Lester Falls apart at the KRES traffic van, broken down at the crossroads since 1972.
Ain't no traffic, really.
Watch where you're going! Jeez!
Hey, Victor, you need a ride?
Yeah.
What are you gonna trade for it? We're Indians, remember? We barter.
Thomas, you gotta look like a warrior.
First of all, quit grinning like an idiot. Indians ain't supposed to smile like that. Get stoic. You gotta look like you just came back from killing a buffalo.
But our tribe never hunted buffalo. We were fishermen.
This ain't Dances with Salmon, you know?
When Victor's father walked out 10 years ago, he left behind a burning secret that consumed his family. Now, Victor is about to leave the reservation for the first time.
You guys got your passports?
But it's the United States.
That's as foreign as it gets.
On a search for the ways of his tribe.
Thomas! I'm going for help!
The importance of family. And the truth about his father.
I know how it started.
Nobody knows how it started.
You have to remember one thing, Victor. He went back for you.
Smoke Signals.
You guys are heroes, you know? It's like you're the Lone Ranger in Tonto.
It's more like we're Tonto and Tonto.
Okay, so Smoke Signals is about two young men that live on a reservation in Idaho. Victor, who plays basketball, doesn't really have a lot of direction in his life. And Thomas, who is who's kind of geeky, very much more the kind of stereotype of a Native American. Thomas, when he was young, his parents died in a fire and was saved by Victor's father, Arnold. And as a result, Thomas kind of idolizes Arnold. Arnold ran off about like 10 years before the film starts and went to Phoenix, Arizona, where he died, where he ends up dying at the beginning of the film. So Joseph and Victor go to collect his ashes, and it's basically a road trip from there. They arrive in Phoenix, where they meet Arnold's friend, Susie, who gives them the ashes and everything, and ends up revealing to Victor that Arnold was the one who actually caused the fire that killed Thomas's parents. And yeah, it's basically about reconciling with, you know, who your father is. It's reconciling, you know, just with what it is to be indigenous in America in the 90s.
Thank you. And Will, why did you pick this?
So, my family, my mom's side of the family lives on a reservation. I am part Native, and this is a film that I have seen so many times just because it's something that my sister would throw on as a comfort film. I would visit family I would visit family and they'd end up being like, hey, you want to watch Smoke Signals? Yeah, let's watch Smoke Signals. And is it, from my own experiences visiting the res, it is like pitch perfect. Is a pitch perfect representation of that particular time in on a reservation in the American West. And yeah, it's just a film that I have had a lot of experience with in my life. And part of picking was also Dan had a list of, you know, kinds of films we hadn't watched. And one of them was, you know, a indie Sundance films. And most of the ones that I have a lot of connection to were very successful. Smoke Signals had some success, and it actually won a bunch of awards at Sundance, but it wasn't, you know, big mainstream crossover.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you. Had anybody other than Will seen this before?
Nope.
Okay. Well, Will, thank you very much. And you know, you've kind of explained your history with the movie. What does this movie do for you? Like, what's like as a movie? What do you think of it?
So, I mean, I'm as a person. I am 100% like I'm 100% Arnold, who left the reservation and has never looked back. And there's a line in it that basically when Indians go away, they don't come back. And I mean, I still feel connection. I mean, every single day I feel connection. Anytime I talk to family, I feel connection. But yeah, it's just like that's what it feels to me is if I go back, I have to. Yeah, it has to be, it's almost always going to be for a funeral or something like that. And which honestly is a little depressing, but also, I mean, it's going back for a reason.
Sure.
Yeah, so I mean, that's that, and also I will be 100% honest and say growing up, like watching the film was having like such a crush on Thomas, on the character of Thomas, who's played by Evan Adams. Mm-hmm. And then finding out also that he is a queer native person was also like, okay, you know what? Yeah, this is why I have a connection to this film. There's okay. Like another film he did. What was the name of it? The Business of Fancy Dancing, that goes directly into it. And I could have, a part of me almost picked that as well, just because it's also his character in that is a person that lives in the white world, for lack of a better term, and is also grasping with their being native and also being queer, but also, and then reconciling that with who they are.
Okay.
Where they live.
Well, thank you. Dave, what do you think about this?
This is normally not a film, the type of film I would gravitate towards, kind of indie, kind of coming of age, kind of slice of life stuff. Yeah. Like, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just kind of not my taste. But I really enjoyed this. I thought it was, yeah, obviously, it's a community and a world that I'm not familiar with at all. But yeah, I thought there was lots of really interesting themes in this, particularly around kind of the idea of storytelling and whether it sort of matters if your stories are true. Mm-hmm. I picked it because you got this thing of Vincent being kind of annoyed with Thomas's kind of storytelling, and then you get to hear later on that Arnold had a very similar way of telling overblown stories that weren't true, so you suddenly kind of get why that's such a hot button thing for Vincent. Yeah, I thought the two leads are really good in their respective roles. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting script. It's you go on a bit of a roller coaster with these two guys. I mean, I definitely got a sense that, whether deliberate or not, that Thomas was very sort of neurodivergent coded, mm-hmm. especially in some of the scenes when he was younger, like after Vincent's dad leaves and Thomas just kind of flagrantly says, did he not love you? And obviously young Vincent's kind of like not particularly proportionate response to that, but But like, again, Thomas isn't, you get a sense Thomas isn't asking that to be cruel. He's just doesn't get that that's not a question you ask to somebody after their father's just left, you know. I just, is it the opening bits of it are really good. Like the, I love the traffic report guy on top on top of his van reporting that I almost saw a car once, basically. And then kind of connecting to that, those two women who just sort of spend all their time driving in reverse because why not? Like, it's not like there's any other traffic around here.
I
enjoyed this, and yeah, it's a film that I probably wouldn't have watched off my own back if it were not for this podcast. So yeah, but it's, so I'm pleased to have watched it.
Nice. Wendy, how about yourself? What'd you think?
I thought this was fantastic. It's almost embarrassing that I haven't seen this movie. It's been on my radar since it came out. And I've always meant to, and I just haven't made time for it. And I'm really glad that we watched it. Not just is it like an important movie in how, you know, its production. It was just a really good movie. It's a road movie about finding and forgiving fathers, right? And that story is actually pretty universal, but it's told through a very specific lens that I really enjoyed. I loved these characters, Victor and especially Thomas, who I agree does feel very neurodivergent coded. And I love how it sort of evolves over time, you know, that his parents, you know, died in the fire when he was a baby. He doesn't really have a father figure, but he does, right? He's kind of glommed onto Victor's dad as his father figure. And the more we see of, what's his name, Arnold?
Yeah.
Arnold's the father. The more we see like who Thomas has modeled himself after. Right. Both the storytelling elements and even I think the way that he speaks is a little bit modeled after that character. I thought it was a great story. I loved the cast, and I love that it's such a snapshot, right, of like a 90s indie darling kind of a movie. You know, that was really fun to experience because there aren't a lot of those movies that I haven't seen. And it was kind of fun to open up a time capsule into that period of time.
Awesome, thank you, Wendy. Like both Dave and Wendy, this is not a movie that I probably would have thought to pick up on my own, but I enjoyed it. I thought that it was pretty good. I did kind of find myself, you kind of almost grade 90s indie stuff on a bit of a curve, and I felt like maybe like if this had been like a bigger budget movie, I might not have enjoyed it as much, if that makes any sense. But the acting was really good. The two lead actors were just really, 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 really good. Victor, it would have been really easy to make Victor just incredibly unlikable. You know, he's clearly grown up with a lot of anger, and he takes it out on whoever happens to wander into his field of vision. But, and we see that at like in the very beginning when he's playing basketball with the two other kids, and he just kind of cowers them into accepting that he'd been fouled, you know. The actor that played him, and I don't have it in front of me, I'm sorry.
Adam Beach,
thank you. Is very, very charismatic, and brought a lot of that to Victor that I really enjoyed. Gary Farmer, the actor who played Arnold, is incredible. That's another character, like, you should hate Arnold for everything that he does in this movie. But Gary Farmer is one of those actors who kind of makes every movie he's in just a little bit better because he's in it.
I've seen him a lot recently in Resident Alien.
Yes.
He's got a regular role in Resident Alien.
Yes, he's got a regular role in Resident Alien. He's wonderful in that. And he's wonderful in this. He is not a good guy, but he has regrets at the end, and you kind of feel that he, even though we don't actually get to see it, that he has grown over the course of his life. Yeah, Gary Farmer just sells that really, really well. You know, like yourselves, I immediately clocked onto, you know, Thomas as being portrayed as kind of coded neurodivergent, you know, both just in the way that he doesn't quite understand how he's supposed to react to things. And it, even just his speech pattern is very believable and works really well for the character. Yeah, I really enjoyed this. I thought this was really, really nice. I do feel bad. I feel like, because I know that this was picked up and released by Miramax, if this had come out like 2 or 3 years earlier, it probably would have been one of those big 90s movies. You know, I think it just came out a little bit too late for it to kind of get that mainstream recognition that a lot of other Miramax releases got in the mid-90s. But very, very worthwhile movie. I truly enjoyed it a lot more than, I'm not going to say more than I thought I would, because I figured it was probably going to be pretty good. But yeah, I was a little bit surprised at how much I really liked it. To the point that I actually wound up watching this twice. I watched it and then Wendy hadn't seen it, so then we both watched it. And I enjoyed it just as much the second time around.
I think one of the things that helps it is it feels like very honest and like it's trying to just tell a straight up story. There's a lot of kind of indie darling films out there, which I think from that kind of time period, where it feels like sometimes the filmmakers are just trying to show how clever they are mm-hmm. in some of their, either in how they're subverting something or how they're portraying something. Whereas this felt like, they just wanted to tell a story from that perspective. Mm-hmm. And it just a straight up, like, it's a very simple story, and it's a story that's been told in very different ways, but like, as Wendy said, through the specific lens of the experience of these people. And I think that's why it works, is mm-hmm. because it's not trying to show how, I don't know, like, hip and with it, like, which a lot of, as again, sort of, and I think we'll probably possibly get to a bit later, how there are some kind of 90s independent films who were sort of like, just like the cliche of a 90s independent film with telling a story of a group of slackers in a coming of age story in, depressed Detroit or something. But hey, look, we've got a killer soundtrack and all the characters are snarky and mm-hmm. you know the kind of film I'm talking about.
I do, and I suspect you'll have more to say later. yeah, I mean, it's true. Yeah, the 90s indie boom had a lot of 24-year-olds who had something to say about life, man. Movies, truthfully, you could, a lot of it you could categorize either they were trying to remake Annie Hall, they were trying to remake Easy Rider, which kind of this is what this was. Or from like 95 on, they were trying to remake Pulp Fiction. Like, those were kind of your choices. And the fact that this feels like just a regular movie about regular people having a regular experience was refreshing, honestly. Like, the wackiest, in quotes, wackiest moment was probably the guy sitting on top of the trailer commenting on cars that go by. And that felt a little bit like it was almost included specifically for the trailer so that the movie would feel more like a 90s indie movie.
That's also like a really nice piece of scene setting, though.
Just it is. In terms Absolutely.
Of like setting up the just basic life on the reservation is the fact that it's sort of like it's slow moving and there isn't much traffic.
Yeah.
Like the day to day lives of these characters is like Thomas is looking after his grandmother. Vincent is just sort of like just bouncing around, not doing much because there's kind of not much to do.
Like, one of the things I will speak to is all reservations are different. So I'm not saying it's not 100%. If somebody who lives in a reservation in the East is not going to have the exact same experience, but like literally as you were mentioning, the two women that are driving around in the car in reverse. On reservations, we have what are called res cars. Res cars are cars that would not be safe to drive any place else, but because reservations tend to have their own like set of laws and stuff, like there's an entire thing. If somebody were to commit a crime on the res, the feds would have a next to impossible time actually coming onto the Rez to actually do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And but yeah, in this case, like, that car probably only drives in reverse. They aren't doing it because it's fun. They're doing it because it's stuck in that gear. They can't do anything about it, so they just drive it.
Thank you. Yeah. and I think there one of the great jokes about the traffic truck is that it's been broken down in that spot since 1972, and they kind of reference that, right? Like, that nobody drives that truck there. He just goes out to the truck where it has been broken down for what at that point 25, 26 years to do the traffic report.
But also, I mean, like, it's kind of like speaks to a universal thing, too, because I also remember being 20 years old in a town with nothing going on. And you would find these things to do to just liven your evening up a little bit. Let's, you know, I frequently, me and my friends, we would say, let's see if we can drive without actually stopping the car once. If you had to get in, you had to jump into a slightly moving car. If you had to jump out to get out. You know, it's just these things that you do when you're a kid. And that also struck me as a very universal thing.
Yeah. And some reservations are giant to the point where, yeah, somebody could have lived their entire life on it without ever actually leaving the res. Mm-hmm. And hence the entire line about, oh, you're going to the United States. Do you have your passport? Because it's stepping from one world into another. Like, they have their own ecosystem and economy half the time where, you know, you may not go your entire life without having a proper quote unquote job, just doing, you know, things here and there for aunties and stuff. And then just getting like a few bucks for your help or whatever and honestly, half the time you get your food from commodities that are given out by the government. You just go to the tribal office. You go to the clinic on the res. And sometimes, hey, if you need anything, there's a hospital that's in the nearest town nearby that you can go to instead.
I also think there was like an interesting through line about identity in it as well. Because like, there's that bit near the start where Vincent tells Thomas that he's not presenting himself properly. Yeah, in the way that he should be, and says, like, yeah, you got your hair in braids, and why are you always wearing a suit? And sort of like, yeah, he basically urges him to change, let his hair down and stuff. And it's sort of, it's about sort of Vincent saying that Thomas isn't presenting himself right as a member of his own people, even though he is one of his own people, and therefore surely however he presents himself is right. But I mean, obviously this is not something I can speak on with any authority, but like that kind of discussion between the two of them, I thought was interesting in terms of sort of like how you present yourself to the outside world.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely an element of just stop being such a fucking nerd, Thomas, to that whole experience. But yeah, I mean, I will admit that my initial reaction to some of what was going on was like, I don't know that anybody is this Native American. It seems like they're just trying it on. But then I thought to myself, you know what? I grew up Boston Irish Catholic, right? How many family gatherings ended with grown men with tears in their eyes singing songs about how Tommy O'Flaherty was murdered by the English, right? Like
all of them, right?
Yeah, all of them. Every single last one of them. Dave, but
sorry.
Yeah, I know.
I promise I'll stop killing the Irish.
Yeah, he's personally sent them to Australia, but like, that's a thing. So once I kind of took that on board, it's like, okay, I get it. This is definitely something that, you know, people do, especially when they're young, as they're trying on their identities. And that's kind of, yeah, definitely Thomas is sort of trying on an identity to a certain extent. But who doesn't do that when they're in their early 20s, right? And it's something that he's become very good at. You know, he's telling these stories, and they're really, again, it doesn't matter if they're true or not, or if they've got an element of truth to them. You know, he's just keeping that oral tradition going in his own way. And I think that's really cool.
I think there's also something in that conversation about Victor kind of commenting on the way that Native Americans are typically portrayed in the media and especially in film. but he's kind of leaning into Thomas a little bit. Like, he kind of at some point asks him like how many, he makes a joke about having seen Dances with Wolves like 100 times, and then it turns out that he actually has seen it and really kind of embraces that romanticized concept.
And then there's the line later on, the only thing sadder than watching Indians on TV is Indians watching TV.
Yeah, which like goes like the casting of Gary Farmer, in that he is a very not what you what a white person would expect to see playing in a Native American movie in 1998. You know, he's just a guy. He's just a regular guy. You know, like this is kind of the point where Graham Greene was in everything, right? Graham Greene, and he's an amazing actor and a wonderful actor, but he specialized in the very stoic, romanticized Native American character from Dances with Wolves. You know, he took off that character in Maverick, but he did it super, super well. He was, but like, then you've got someone like Gary Farmer, who's just not playing into that at all. He's just a regular guy. And it, I don't know, it's almost like a statement in and of itself that nobody in this movie acts the way that Victor is telling us that Native Americans act in movies. You know, nobody is being a stereotype in this.
And the thing is, like, I will be 100% on the record of, I'm almost surprised Graham Greene wasn't in this film, because like the Native film scene is very very small, where to the point where actors, if they're in one film that features primarily a Native cast, they're probably in at least two or three others. I mean, the sheer amount of people in this film that are also in, a good example would be, there's a Canadian zombie film called Blood Quantum, and I think like at least a quarter of this cast is in that also. But yeah, I mean, or also just the sheer amount of people in this film that also did voices in Disney's Pocahontas. Mm-hmm. Right down to Irene Bedard herself, who voiced Pocahontas in the film.
Yeah. And like, I know that this movie also had a number of cast members from Northern Exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, Elaine Miles. I love her.
Yeah, she's great. And like, Adam Beach was Squanto, wasn't he?
I believe so.
I've got Northern Exposure. It's just dropped on Amazon Prime like a couple of weeks ago. I've got it on my watch list to give it. I've not watched it since the 90s, so
yeah,
give that another run.
I wonder how it holds up.
Yeah, I will admit that in the time, I was not a big fan of Northern Exposure, because it felt a little too pleased with itself. But it had some great acting in it, so I'm wondering, like yourself, if I'd like it more now. But yeah, and of course, and again, like we always said, Gary Farmer was in, like, at this time, he'd been in like Pow Wow Highway, Jim Jarmusch's Dead Man, you know, things like that. He just, you know, he was the guy to get when you needed a Gary Farmer type.
Yeah. And then Tantu Cardinale, who played Victor's mom, and she had been doing like, you know, work in years. There's a film, Loyalties, that she was in, that's basically about where she plays a housekeeper, and it involves like murder and her friendship with the white woman that is of the man that's murdered and everything. But also like one of the films that she did like a few years ago, Fall Around Her, which is excellent, where she's playing a singer who decides to go back to the res after being away for years. And it's a pretty excellent, the film itself isn't the best, but her performance in it is pretty excellent. It also has like the one thing I think this film was missing, which is, but mind you, it's mostly something that I always saw like my aunts and my female cousins doing, which is literally just in the middle of the day, hey, we're just going to throw on some like Rita Coolidge or Buffy St. Marie and just start singing along. It's the equivalent of, you know, the Irish uncles all just starting to, you know, sing together.
Songs of their fathers. Yeah. But I mean, you know, to your point, I mean, there's just, especially then, the pool of acting, like established acting talent, you know, with, you know, in the Native American community was not huge, which makes it all the more remarkable that this movie, again, in 1998, didn't have Graham Greene or Wes Studi, right? Because those were the actors you got. And it's like, well, no, we've actually got quite a few more. And it was really nice to, for them to be able to have that showcase that I just wish more people had gotten to see.
Yeah. And one of the other ways that we didn't mention that the film is notable is that almost the entire production crew is also Native. The director is, the writer is, which that means also kind of having to briefly talk about Sherman Alexie, which, has allegations, and we don't talk about him anymore.
Okay.
Which kind of sucks because, you know, when you literally have, hey, here's a notable Native writer who has, you know, won multiple awards for young adult stuff, including what this is based off of. And then, yeah, they turn out to be a pest.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. But even then, yeah. But still, we're back to the point, like, that it's notable. I think it's not like the first outright film shot entirely by native filmmakers, but it's like the first to get like distribution.
Mm-hmm. And it only took 90 years.
Yeah.
All I'd say is if you're like me, and when it comes to sort of films like this that you don't normally kind of go towards it, I would recommend fighting past that, and this is worth your time.
Absolutely.
And if it's been on your watch list since it came out, just go see it, because it was absolutely delightful. And it is embarrassing that you have waited since 1998 to watch this movie.
Yeah. And speaking of embarrassing, oh my God, Adam Beach, I'm so sorry they put you in that Bob wig at the end.
Oh,
the wig.
Literally.
It was a wig. Oh God, I was looking at it going, is that a wig or is it just where they cut his hair short and it looks weird? It's just like, no, that's a wig. Honestly, it's a relief to know that was a wig.
That actually reminds me of one thing that I did have about this movie. And it wasn't like a deal breaker by any stretch of the imagination, is that they make a couple of references to, and then this character cut their hair. And I, again, I'm not Native. I vaguely kind of understood that that was a thing, but the movie doesn't really explain it to anybody that doesn't know what that means. Like, you can kind of pick it up from context. I know it's just basically like, you know, I'm a different person now. I've gone through this thing and now I'm a different person. But I do kind of wish that the movie had explained that a little more for people that didn't understand what they were doing.
Yeah. Like, honestly, the one thing that I find unbelievable about the film, when Victor gets back at the end and Arlene, his mother, sees him for the first time, the first thing she out of her mouth is not, "What the hell did you do with your hair?"
Take that damn wig off. You look like a fool.
I don't know. It just sounds like maybe I need to try fry bread.
Oh, no. Good fry bread will change your life. Yeah. But then again, also, the thing is, all good Indian boys, their mom makes the best fry bread they've ever had in their life.
I've loved you from the moment we met.
Then why didn't you tell me?
We were working together. I didn't want anything to interfere.
And all this time, I thought,
cut. That's a cut. Okay, we're back in. We are back. We are in. All right, hold it down, people. Hold it down.
Scene 6, rolling.
Today, I'm not going to settle for okay. This is a big scene, and I'm not leaving till we get it.
Whatever it takes, Nick. We're here for you.
You're a great director, man. Your films are totally whack.
I'm excited to be working with you.
You were really great in that Richard Gere movie.
I'm ready, Nick.
Right now, we're making a fucking movie! Action!
I had this dream last night. I was on set. Everything was going wrong, and no matter how hard I tried to keep things together, the more they just fell apart. But you know what that dream was telling me, Nicole? That I just have to roll with it.
The light!
Is everything?
the milk.
What's gonna happen next?
Everyone just relax.
Nick!
What?
I feel like shit.
Sitting on Joey feels fake. I can't act. I should just do shower scenes in Richard Gere movies for the rest of my life.
The only place I've seen dwarves in dreams is in stupid movies like this.
Call me a cab.
I'm gonna have a heart attack.
No, you're not. Or if you do, save it for the end of the scene, okay?
Okay, next up, we have another 90s indie darling. It's Tom DiCillo's Living in Oblivion. This is basically a movie about making movies, which is everybody's favorite. Basically, this is the story of a, you know, kind of a low-budget indie movie getting made, and the trials and tribulations that the director is kind of going through. We see, you know, he's making a movie, you know, they're shooting a scene where a woman is kind of confronting her mother for not helping her when her father beat her as a kid. And they're trying to get through this extremely emotional scene, and like the mic boom keeps coming into shot, the focus puller isn't getting his shot correctly. You know, people start to lose their lines, and the light gets blown, and just one thing after another, and they just can't get the shot, and the actors are getting less and less focused, and finally, you know, the actress playing the mom kind of strokes the other actress's hair a little bit, and it reminds her of her own mother dying, which kind of brings her to life, and so they're both giving this powerhouse performance, but oh, the camera wasn't on because the cinematographer drank spoiled milk. It turns out that's just a stress dream. So then we go to the next morning, and we have the Hollywood actor is kind of doing, you know, he's kind of coming in to, you know, bring some credibility to this little indie movie. And it turns out he's a complete asshole and kind of an idiot. He's constantly changing his blocking and trying new things, and he wants to go over here and come from off camera, but mostly he just kind of wants to be in front all the time. And, you know, he basically just assholes himself to the point that Nick, the director, finally just beats him up. And then that turns out to be a dream from the lead actress. And finally we get to the real scene, which is a dream sequence involving a dwarf actor in a tuxedo holding an apple. And Peter Dinklage quite rightly calls the director out for what the unbelievably crap hackneyed scene this is. Yeah, I don't know. It's just, it's an indie movie. Everything goes wrong until something goes right. Why did I pick this one? I have actually seen this movie many, many times. I watched this back in 1995 when it came out, and really, really liked it because I was very much into that scene at that time. I was constantly going to indie shows and picking up movies like this, and this kind of spoke to me on that level. It's got a great cast. It's got just a who's who of indie independent film actors from the mid 1990s. You got Steve Buscemi, you got Catherine Keener, Kevin Corrigan is kind of in it in the background before he kind of became a little bit better known. And it also was Peter Dinklage's first main acting role, which is pretty cool in and of itself. Had anybody seen this before?
Many times.
You have?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Well, Wendy, what do you think of this movie?
It's a delight. I mean, it's like peak 90s indie stuff, right? Because it's specifically talking about, well, it's set in the film industry. That's maybe not what it's talking about, right? But it's set in the, it's very self-referential. It's a meta movie, right? It's an indie movie about making an indie movie. And as wacky as some of the things happening in it are, it's really about just the grind of making a movie and just trying to get one fucking scene and their inability to do that. But then it's also really multi-layered, like with all of these dreams about the movie, then the movie's filming the dream sequence. Like, it's really playing with this whole element. Like, Nick's last name is Rev, which is means dream. Like, it's so much, it's very clever. Which maybe is why I can get it being like a little bit too peak 90s, indeed early movie for some, but, I enjoy it. And I love Steve Buscemi. He's so great in this. And Catherine Keener is great in this, sort of before she like found that niche that she's built in so many movies of like the ultimate bitch. Like, she's still kind of soft and vulnerable in this movie. James DeGross is such an asshole. He's so fucking great as this complete dipshit asshole. And it is a delight just to see Peter like Dinklage in his first film credit, walking around holding that apple. It's delight. I really like this movie. It's very much of its time.
All right, Will, how about yourself? What do you think of this?
I have some idea what Dave's thoughts in the film. But I will say I probably land between Wendy and Dave here, where I think there are some fantastic performances in the film. And that's what saves it for me. Like, there are times where I start getting exasperated by, okay, and it's another dream sequence. And this is a dream sequence. How do you know what happened in his dream sequence? Is this a dream within a dream sequence? Is the entire film a dream sequence? Are we going to wake up and find out that the entire film was taking place in a child's snow globe? But back to the point. No, I think it has some fantastic performances. There are a few times I feel like the film is just a hint up its own ass. But at the same time, like, I mean, Catherine Keener is absolutely fucking terrific in the film. Like, there are multiple points where I'm like, yes, please tell this idiot how what you feel about him. Steve Buscemi. Like, I feel like we're at a point in his career where he is still, like, you know, an actor who just happens to have that kind of face where it's like very distinguishably himself, and he's not quite to hello, you fellow young people.
He hasn't made Armageddon yet, so he's still kind of not quite broken through to the mainstream.
Yeah. And then obviously, like, Dermot Mulroney is the person that went on to be on The Practice, be it, like, you know, on TV shows here and there. And here he's just, you know, playing this, like, director of photography who is just, like, completely and utterly, like, I am so important, and has the name Wolf Uberman, which is such a freaking porn name, and he dresses like he's going to the leather bar. And I love that.
So, again, I just want to point out that this, like the thing that everybody makes, I don't think Dylan McDermott was in The Practice. Dylan McDermott Mulroney. From the dawn of time, everybody has gotten those two actors confused.
Oh, right, yeah, because he was the one who was Julia Roberts' best friend in My Best Friend's Wedding. I guess.
He was Gavin on Friends.
Okay.
To Rachel, I really mean it. Okay. And also, yes, that movie is entirely up its own ass. That is absolutely true. All right, Dave, let's hear it. Tell us about your thoughts on this movie.
I would like to preface this with saying that I do think the performances are very good. This has got like a very good cast. It's kind of interesting seeing Dermot Mulroney, who traditionally has been sort of like, you know, cast as the handsome guy in stuff, playing this goofball. Who is this entirely unserious man. but yeah, despite the fact that it's got a good cast and the performances are good, I hated this.
Okay.
I mean, where that first dream sequence came to an end, I've been watching it, and I actually went, how long did that go on for? I actually paused it to find out how long that went on for. While Ginny was sat in the background laughing her ass off, because she'd pegged within about like 5 minutes so I wasn't getting on with this. Mm-hmm. I just looked at it, like 25 minutes of my time in this film had wasted on something that was a dream and therefore wasn't relevant. And then it did it again. And then, like, yeah, just like the narrative bumps, like, for my liking, the narrative bumps around, like, it's like a series of, like, vignettes. It's like they wanted to make a series of short films that you threw together into one big long film.
That is kind of what happened, actually.
Yeah. And, like, if you were into those, you know, that kind of film scene at the time, or if you made films at the time, I am sure that all of this really resonates in terms of what it must have been like to make that, and the grind of doing take after take after take on something like that when there's so much out of your control. But as somebody who wasn't and was just watching this as a film viewer, there were a lot of periods of this where I was just kind of bored, because you do end up seeing the same scene over and over and over again with varying degrees of acting commitment, and then something goes wrong in the background again. And yeah, I just found this a struggle. It just wasn't my thing.
That's completely valid. That is, I absolutely 100% understand where you come from on this.
Yeah, to be honest, if it hadn't been the fact that I needed to watch it for this podcast, I would have rage quit after the first dream sequence was revealed.
Again, that is fair. Yeah. I absolutely get that.
But, and again, like, I don't want it to look like, because the performances are great. Like, mm-hmm. I can't. That was the kind of the weird dichotomy for me. It's like, you know, these are very good actors and they're giving very good performances. But it was the script writing choices and some of the directorial choices that were just making me mad. Mm-hmm. like the fact that in the first kind of dream sequencing, the whole thing's done in this kind of grainy black and white stuff, except when they're doing the filming, at which point it goes into color. And then in the second dream sequence, they do the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. I just felt that was kind of like the director patting himself back on the back for doing the kind of flip. Look, I've changed it all up now, and it's kind of like, I won't go into grinding my teeth about it too much, just because, like, I get that the audience who would have, especially who would have viewed this at the time, mm-hmm. would have loved it for what it was doing, what it was talking about and stuff, but I just did not click with this at all. And, like, in a way, I'm kind of extra irritated that I didn't, because of how good the cast and the performances are. You know what I mean? It's like having such a good cast who are working really well, and yet the film overall is just driving me bananas. It's like this weirdly, this kind of like cognitive dissonance of me seeing how good everyone was, and yet at the same time not liking it at all.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. This movie is not unpretentious. And it also wants you to find the tedium and the grind of making an independent movie to be as fascinating as the people who make independent movies do. I completely get that. And I do think that a lot of that, for me personally, had to do with where I was at the time when I saw this movie in my life. But at the end of the day, I do find that this movie speaks to me on some level as somebody that still enjoys, obviously, movies. I'm still a movie guy. But the performances are just so incredible. Steve Buscemi is just kind of playing Steve Buscemi here. Like, this is sort of the Steve Buscemi role. But nobody does it better, you know? And Catherine Keener is, like, on another level. It takes a really, really, really great actress to play a mediocre actress well. And I think that that's something that she does extremely well in this movie. Nicole, the actress, is fine. She's okay. She had a nude scene in a Richard Gere movie. That's kind of where she's at right now in her career. And she's really questioning herself, and she's really, you know, in not a great place with where she is in life. But also, it's hard for her to kind of connect with the character until something happens, and she is capable of giving these performances. She just finds it very difficult. And Catherine Keener just sells that so amazingly well. Yeah, I cannot say enough good things about Keener in this movie. She's just incredible. And yeah, Dave, to your point too, seeing Dermot Mulroney just play such an idiot is it's really cool. And they were actually married at the time, Keener and Mulroney.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's just such like the kind of role that you don't expect him to play. So I know, to this day, I still, for me, he's Fancy Man from New Girl.
Yeah. He's got great comic chops in that as well.
He does. Like, he does. He's a funny guy.
He is low key hilarious.
Yeah, he's a very
often
funny
guy. Doesn't get a chance to show that off.
Yeah, but just like him walking around in his eye patch.
I think I should have an eye patch.
Yeah. Oh God, James LaGrosse. Can we talk about James LaGrosse for a minute?
I would like to point out the only mention of this film in the classic indie book Spike, Mike, Slackers, and Dykes is literally just talking about that performance and how it is not based off of Brad Pitt.
Everybody thinks that that's supposed to be Brad Pitt because DiCillo had made Johnny Suede before this, starring Brad Pitt and Catherine Keener. And he like swears blind. That is absolutely, it is not Brad Pitt. I promise it's not Brad Pitt. Another rumor is that it's Val Kilmer. And he's a lot quieter on that one.
That I could believe.
Yeah.
Because my first thought watching it is like, oh, this is Brad Pitt. And then I look it up. Wait, it's not based off. Because I didn't even realize that rumor existed when I was watching the film.
Yeah, very much
so. I read on the IMDb trivia for this that at one point, Brad Pitt was going to play that part.
Mm-hmm.
So that would have
been interesting to see.
Yeah, I think 94, yeah, because 94 was the year that Interview with the Vampire came out. So he kind of between Johnny Suede and this blew up.
Yeah, because he was doing a lot of independent stuff for a long time, wasn't he, before he went full on movie star. He was kind of switching between kind of like, you know, things like Legends of the Fall. He was still doing things like California and stuff.
California and Film and Louise and stuff like that. But,
yeah.
But Interview with the Vampire is kind of what blew him up big. And I guess he just got too expensive. You know, like these actors all paid to be in this movie. They just wanted to make it. They wanted to be in this.
Yep. Two of the actors literally have roles because they gave money to the production.
Yeah.
Like they're not actors. Like they're just people.
The sound guy and the script girl.
Yes.
And the first AD is also like the executive producer. She also put up a ton of money, although she was always going to be in it.
Side note, the boom mic operator, like, what he was wearing was very distracting. I'm like, okay, yes, thank you for bringing the apps to the show. Thank you very much for that.
I was reading an interview and he said, yeah, that was just my wife's trainer. I just thought he was funny. So again, this movie is just by and large, it's a bunch of friends getting together to make a movie, which honestly, I always have time for. You know, it's just on a bigger scale than most movies like that.
But also, I think sometimes, like films that are made with that ethos, it's sometimes more fun for the people making it than it might be for the people who are actually watching it. Like they may, I'm sure they will absolutely have a blinding time.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe, yeah. And again, everybody's mileage varies, and I appreciate that my experience is different. But like, yeah, I definitely felt that it was sort of like, this is a film that is clearly made by people who have a love of that particular subject matter and know a lot about it. But because I don't, and I'm not particularly interested in it, I sort of don't care.
Yeah. Fair. Absolutely fair.
And I hate being the voice of dissent on this one, because clearly this does have this film does have a lot of love in terms of like both when it was released and to this day. And again, it's sort of like there's nothing wrong with the acting in it. It was purely just sort of like the script and the way it was put together that I found irritating. But like, movies, again, it's
movies about movie making definitely turn a lot of people off. That's the thing, you know. Like this movie absolutely accurately, it seems, portrayed the grind of indie movie making, where you're getting what you get. You know, you're not getting the best focus puller in the business. You're not getting the best boom mic operator you can find. You're getting the guy that you can afford to show up at 4 o'clock in the morning in a crappy New York neighborhood drinking spoiled milk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's probably still high from last night. But he's gonna assist your cameraman as best he can under the circumstances, you know.
I guess it's sort of like the movie making equivalent of somebody going, "Oh, wouldn't it be fun to make a film of our D&D game?"
Yeah,
you know, we have a lot of fun playing it, but it wouldn't necessarily be as fun for anybody else watching it.
Yeah, very few people are Critical Role.
If you're going to do that, you'd make it an anime and runs for 26 episodes in the 90s. Yeah.
Very few people are Dimension 20. You know, it's the vast majority of those are absolutely fucking unwatchable, Dave. You're absolutely right. And that is kind of what's here. And it didn't work for you. And I get that. And I totally respect it.
But I will say Peter Dinklage was fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure we'd all agree. And just like, I mean, like his perpetual scowl.
Yes.
The entire time that he's on screen.
Yeah.
Just looking furious the entire time he's there, just simmering anger the whole time until he finally loses it.
Yeah.
And in universe, you can tell he probably took this role, the character, not the Peter Dinklage himself, because this is the what he could get work for. This, and he is probably actually legitimately the best actor in this like film, and he's just fed up with this bullshit.
Yeah,
I think that what that scene especially kind of brings across, although I think all of the scenes do this, is that Nick Rev is making basically the worst movie ever made. Everything in this movie is a hackney cliche, right? Everything in this movie is, you know, you've got, like, again, the mom, you know, the daughter confronting the mom scene is just very, that is like page one of the 90s indie drama handbook right there. The love scene, in quotes, is just basically like, I've watched a bunch of 40s movies, you know, and this scene, like, this dream sequence is just every dream sequence you've ever seen in every crappy movie ever, you know. As you know, Dinklage even points out, I don't have dreams with dwarves in them. But that's what you do in a bad movie. You know,
like,
you put a dwarf in a dream sequence to let people know that this must be a dream.
Like, it was to the point where I was trying to figure out, are the scenes in the dream sequence part of the film that these people are just dreaming about, or are they just dreams? Because if they're part of the film, the plot is somehow even more indecipherable than Goddess, the stage play in Showgirls.
But yeah, Dinklage is incredible in this movie. I mean, he's become an enormous star and well-deserved, because this role had to speak to him.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this role and the lines that this character has are kind of like his manifesto for his career, right? Like, that's how he always approached his career, is that he didn't want to be the dwarf in the dream sequence. Like, he's a trained actor, and that's, he wants roles. He doesn't want to walk around in a powder blue tuxedo holding an apple while the smoke machine like explodes.
Oh my god, that scene of like the brain trust sitting around the smoke machine. Yeah. Oh god, I worked in community theater, and I can tell you that is a very real scene. Do we put the oil in this? Is this where the gas goes? I think maybe both. I don't know. What's this other one? Nah, that's probably fine. Nobody knows what they're talking about, and they just bought themselves a smoke machine at the end.
I'm not always going to say we live in a better world than we did in the 90s, but the fact that you could Google that and not have to try and figure it out on your own now, that is just speaks wonders.
One thing that kind of tickled me about this is the fact that, like you say, Dan, this is about sort of someone making a terrible, terrible independent film. And sort of like, then sort of years later, The Room comes out, and then you got like The Disaster Artist, which is very much kind of like, you know, like Living in Oblivion, except, you know, with the added freeze of the fact that all of this bullshit actually happened, which kind of adds a level of fascination to it in a way that I guess Living in Oblivion doesn't have, because it is fictionalized. It's like, you know, the idea of sort of like a genuinely chaotic film set with an incompetent director who's like shrouded in mystery and, yeah, all the kind of weird shit that kind of goes around that. The fact that that was all a thing that really took place kind of, I guess, maybe kind of makes that, gives that extra layer of fascination to it, whereas obviously this is like a fictionalized version. But the fact that it almost kind of predicted that there'd be this guy with like a long flowing hair and a bit of a peculiar look about him making a terrible film with all of these, yeah, with all of these problems and sort of actors just trying to make it through the day without going nuts. that bit was kind of interesting to me as a factor of it, you know, just in the great scheme of things.
Yeah, because this movie started off life as a short. That first sequence was originally going to be the movie, Living in Oblivion. It turned out to be too long to be considered a short film, so we wound up just making a feature out of it. He says that like everything that happened, like maybe not all happened on the same day, but that was all just basic stuff on the set of Johnny Suede. You know, the light explodes and ruins a take. Somebody gets sick on set and they don't catch what they need to catch. I mean, these are all just things that happen on a set. You just put them all in the same shot. You know, this is what this is. It's not glamorous. There's nothing glamorous about indie filmmaking. You know, like hopefully at the end you've come up with something that's artistic and that you're proud to stand behind, but it's a fucking grind, man. You know? And this, again, came out at a time when indie films were, it was getting to be big business.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. 95 alone, we had Welcome to the Dollhouse. We had Safe. We had Party Girl. We had The Doom Generation. We had The Incredibly Adventure of Two Girls in Love. We had Kids. We had The Last Supper. We had Mighty. We had just so many freaking films featuring people that would just blow up. Mm-hmm. And it's just.
And like the year before this was, you know, Clerks and El Mariachi and like these people just becoming household names overnight. You know, Reservoir Dogs came out not long before this, you know, like.
And Pulp Fiction was 94 also.
Yeah, but Pulp Fiction is like Indian name only.
Yeah, you know? True. Yeah.
I mean, I love it. Don't get me wrong. It cannot tell you how exciting it was to discover Pulp Fiction in 1994. But like, people were really kind of cottoning onto the idea that, oh, indie filmmaking is such a glamorous, artistic thing. And this movie is like, no, man, it's fucking work. This is not fun.
I may have to revisit this with a bit of distance, knowing what to expect going in this time, and I might end up having a different experience with it.
You might, but again, I mean, it's not an unreasonable reaction to have. This movie is very navel-gazely. This movie is very, everybody's going to find this as fascinating as I do, and some people do and some people don't, and I completely understand where you're coming from, Dave. I absolutely do. Do we have anything else, or are we good?
I dream about a burger also.
Yeah. I love that bit.
That was great. Oh, and the driver. The driver was awesome.
Oh, the driver who is Suze from Gravity Falls?
Yeah. Oh my totally. God, I didn't realize that.
I mean, he's not, but he is.
He was a great character. I really liked him. He was just kind of psychoanalyzing people in the front seat that he's driving around. Yeah, this movie had lots of great little characters. Bob, the gaffer, who's just, you know, in his filthy t-shirt covered in clothespins.
Oh, that t-shirt was gross.
But again, that's the guy you're getting when you're doing an indie movie in 1995 in New York, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know that he knows exactly where to find, you know, Troma headquarters. because he's done plenty of work for them too, you know.
Yeah, certainly. Like, I did note all the sort of a lot of the fashion, especially the hair, was very mid-90s.
Oh yeah,
he was the person who replaced Terry O'Quinn in The Stepfather.
Huh. Oh, was he?
Yeah, Stepfather 3, the gaffer.
Oh wow,
that's the film, Stepfather 3, the gaffer.
The gaffer. I don't think I've ever watched any of the Stepfather movies past the first one.
The second one's apparently just a retread of the first one. With, yeah.
So this is what happens when you can't get Terry O'Quinn.
Yeah. You get the guy who plays the gaffer in Living. Well, no, he did. He played this. He was in Stepfather 3 before that. And it was also in an episode of Madlock.
Ah, okay. He was good, though. He was really great. All right. Well, thank you, people, for being here. Thank you for joining us. Please, please take extra good care of yourselves right now. Please drink some water and go to bed.
Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show was presented by Wendy Abramo, Will Ackerman, Dave Probert, and DJ Toland. Not to worry. Someone will give Tarantino some love at some point. We're really pulling for that guy.
Wendy, your microphone is up, not in front of your mouth. We could hear you. I'll be able to fix it in editing, but I just wanted to let you know.
It's bad.